Welcome to Between Two Chairs, Demystifying Commercial Real Estate, the podcast that brings you the latest insights and trends on the South Florida commercial real estate market with your hosts, Fernando Arencibia Jr. and Jennifer Wollman. In each episode, we dive into the world of commercial real estate and break down complex concepts to make them accessible for everyone. Whether you're a real estate professional, a curious investor, or just interested in the South Florida market in general, Between Two Chairs is the podcast for you. So pull up a chair and join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Between Two Chairs. My name is Fernando Arencibia, and with me, as always, is the very angelic Jennifer Wollman. You have a halo above your head.
I do.
There you go.
My aura is glowing.
Yeah, today. There you go. There you go. Say hello, Jennifer.
Hello, everybody.
All right. So today we're going to be in our efforts to continue to demystify commercial real estate. We're going to be talking about myths of commercial real estate. Right, Jen?
Correct. Correct. And also, it's October, so yeah, we figured we're going to start getting into the spirit of October. So there are a lot of myths in real estate in general, but especially in commercial real estate. Some of them are that real estate in general is easy. You just show property and rake in a ton of money. If you're into commercial real estate, commercial leases are so much easier than sales. You need a lot of money to purchase and invest in real estate. You always make money in real estate if you hold it long enough. Real estate is a passive investment. You just buy a multifamily or a strip center or a warehouse and you just kick back and rake in the money. And then everything with online businesses, the internet, etc., is making real estate and brokerage obsolete. So those are just some of them. There are many, many more, but we try to keep these short and sweet. So we're going to dive into some of them. Let's start with real estate is easy. You just show property and rake in the money.
Well, certainly, you know, even in residential real estate, that's really not the case. There are a lot of steps to success in real estate. And so in commercial, it's even the more complex, right? If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And I think part of it is that in commercial, it's an entire ecosystem that is further specialized in all of the different asset classes. And so, you know, there are a lot of complexities involved in buying, in managing, and in selling commercial real estate.
Right. So what another thought is, so with a residential, you have the MLS, you can look up properties if it's listed by an agent. However, in commercial, there are commercial platforms for sure, right, but they don't tend to have as much information on them as a residential MLS does. What are some other big differences?
Well, for example, when you are searching for commercial real estate, a myth or a sub-myth of this myth could be that the majority of commercial vacancies are readily available. Well, that it's not really the case, right? And so if you are, let's say, a tenant looking for office space, not everything that is available in the marketplace is going to be in one of those, platforms, right? And that has to do with the fact that if you are a company that is managing 100,000 square feet of office space in 10 buildings, right? You know that there are properties that are going to come up in the next 5, 6, 7, 8 months that are going to be available for those that are looking for space, right? But those places, those properties are not going to be set up online, which is why, you know, relationships become very important, and making those calls is ever important, because in commercial leasing, if you're leasing a house, you can find a house probably within a 30-day period. You could probably find a house in a couple of weeks, right? Even if you have to get approval from a homeowners association or a condo association, you're going to be able to find a place rather quickly. In commercial leases, you know, people look 6 to a year in advance, depending on the complexities of what they're looking for. So one of those things is the fact that there might be properties that are not on the market And you may never know that they'll be on the market because they may be leased by the time the current tenant leaves that space. You know, they might already be earmarked. The other thing is, as far as readily available, is also comparable. So, you know, yes, when a property sells, you could go to the property appraiser's office and you can, you know, figure out how much it sold for. And even though you're not going to get the full picture, you're going to get a very close picture of what that is. But commercial leases are, there is a confidentiality involved into that, right? Leasing data is proprietary, right? And there are even clauses in commercial leases that prohibit a tenant from disclosing how much they're paying, what kind of concessions they were given, right? What kind of CAM they're paying, all those kinds of things. And so you never really get all of that data, again, to add to the complexity of transacting in commercial real estate and understanding, right, an investment vehicle through there.
Well, and to your point on the platform, you don't get that. You don't have the information in the sense of what you were talking about with the leases, because leases are so much longer in commercial real estate. Not only do you have the example of something that might be coming up and be vacant 7 or 8 months from now that never hits the platform, if that is on the platform and you need something fairly quickly from a lease perspective, you're the tenant, and then you get on there and half the stuff isn't available for the next 5 or 6 months, but you just found out that your, you know, your lease is up and you didn't remember the renewal clause. And so now you have to find a new place pretty quickly. You also have that. And then to your point about the pricing on a lease and not knowing exactly what a comparable is, pretty much all you have access to is the asking rent. And even then, a lot of the listing platforms don't list what the rent is. So you have to call every single property that's on there that might interest you to find out if the rent is even within your budget, or if you're a broker in your tenant's budget. So let's go into another one about how easy real estate is and the difference with commercial leases are less complex than sales. Because in a, in residential, that is true, right? A rental is pretty straightforward. Yeah. It's 1 year, but in commercial.
No doubt. If you focus on the residential leasing and you do a lot of volume, things move very, very fast, right? And they're very cookie cutter. And you have a standard statewide, you know, lease that most people use, right? That covers from A to Z, every item imaginable, right? But commercial leases are the opposite of easy, right? They are inherently complex. And part of it is because what clauses you're going to have in an industrial space is not the same as a retail space. It's not the same as an office space, right? And even though there are similarities, there are differences in complexity. What also adds to the complexity is that the ownership, right, of the actual asset will add to it, right? If it's a REIT, they might have some requirements that are need to be on the lease. You know, if they have leveraged the property, meaning that they have a loan, the lender may have requirements as to what kind of information they want to have on the lease. So there are a lot of moving parts as to why leases in commercial are complex. But you and I have discussed it before. We have both transacted on either doing a tenant rep or a landlord rep where it has taken months, right, in order for us to come to an agreement with a national firm and to be able to actually have an executed lease and be able to move forward. And then that's just the start of it, because now you got to wait for the build out. And, you know, it takes sometimes, you know, I've just finished being involved in a lease. It took about 21 months, right, from start to finish. Right. Until they're finally moved in and everything is set up and ready. So that's part of what's exciting about commercial real estate, right? Because, you know, no two deals are ever the same, and you learn so much and there are intricacies in it. I have never been in a situation where I could say that two leases are exactly the same in commercial real estate.
Right. Right. All right. So let's get on to another myth.
And to your point that you mentioned initially, which was that leases are less complex than purchases. The reason why that's a myth is because, you know, you can execute a purchase in months, right? But a lease might take you, like, to our point, a couple of years.
Right. Right. You need a lot of money to purchase or invest in real estate. So this is something that I always thought, because obviously my first experience was buying my first home. We needed a mortgage. You need a big, you know, a down payment, etc. But as I got older and got involved in real estate itself as a broker, I found syndication.
Exactly.
Which I love. So let's talk a little bit about.
Well, let's say before you even get to syndication, let's say that we are discussing buying the property outright, right? And one of the things that people sometimes misunderstand about that cost is that while the initial investment is large, meaning that your loan to value, right, your initial deposit is going to be larger, most likely than when you're purchasing residential, that you, if you are buying a property that's already generating revenue, right, that revenue is going to pay for the mortgage that you're going to carry.
Right.
So the initial startup cost, you know, might seem to be large. But remember, if you're already buying an investment product, an investment vehicle that is already generating revenue, you're going to have that as an additional value. And then we have things like syndication.
Right. And so what's great about syndication is that you can get into an investment for less money, especially if you're a limited partner. So there's in syndication, we've spoken about this before, there's the general partner, there's a limited partner. If you get in as a limited partner, it's basically somebody's bringing you the deal. They're telling you what their projections are, how much it's going to cost to get in, how much each one's going to pay, what the return's going to be, etc. And you're basically getting in with a group of like-minded people to purchase a property. So my first syndication, I got in for $10,000 into a multi-million dollar deal. So again, I was starting out. I didn't have a ton of money. I didn't want it to go into the stock market. I already had money in stocks. So you can do syndications. You can also invest, speaking of stocks, you can buy real estate as, like you were saying, in a REIT, right? A real estate investment trust, which is basically real estate that is sold on the stock market. So it's a fund that owns a group of real estate, and you're basically buying into that fund or that company. You can buy hotel REITs, you can buy multifamily REITs, you can buy mixed real estate REITs, and that doesn't take a lot of money. That is literally just almost like buying stocks. You can do crowdfunding, right? Crowdfunding is similar to syndication, but a little less formal, I think.
Right.
So anyway, and there's also, I guess those are the three basic ways. And then also, if you're buying property, again, the amount that you're buying, you know, spending on the $2 million property is basically the down payment required for the loan, not the loan itself. So if you're thinking of investing, don't think that you need to amass a fortune in order to start investing. It has become a lot easier, I should say, to invest cautiously, but with less money, and you don't have to do it alone if you get in with a fund. And that's how a lot of families create wealth, right? They do family funds where everybody in the family pools their money together. And that's not the formal family fund, but I know a lot of people that do that.
Well, you know, you also have the advent of condo warehouses or condo offices, which a lot of people have invested in, which allows you to get basically a piece of the entire building, and you're able to lease it, you're able to make money, and people have done very well with those condo structures. You know, it does require a lot of research, and you want to make sure that you are purchasing in the right place. And like anything where there is a condominium involved, you want to really be able to dig into the numbers and dig into the condo docs to make sure that, you know, you're covered in every angle. But there is great opportunity there.
All righty. Another one. Online businesses are making real estate and their brokers obsolete. So, you know, we always talk, there's always some segment of the real estate asset class that is being hammered in the news and by the markets. You know, a couple years ago or several years ago, it was retail's dead. It's a retail apocalypse. You know, the world's coming to an end. Everyone's buying online. Nobody's ever going to go into a store again. Yeah. Don't invest in retail. Well, today we all know the retail story. Vacancy rates are at an all-time low. They're not building enough retail for the number, you know, for the population growth that we've had. And now office. Office is dead. Nobody's ever going to go back to the office again. Everybody's going to work remotely.
We're definitely not seeing the death of retail and the death of the brick and mortar. In fact, I think that online ventures have figured out that there is great value in having the brick and mortar store. We know statistically that if you have a retail company, the brick and mortar drives more business to the online than those that don't have a brick and mortar at all. Because we're still human. There's something tactile about seeing it, touching it, experiencing it, and looking at the quality of things. I mean, we've all ordered things that we thought were going to be high quality and we were disappointed. And we've all ordered things that we were very, very pleasantly surprised by the quality. But, you know, once you're in a brick and mortar store and you get to see it, the other thing that happens with these companies is they get to define their brand beyond just what is online. So this is definitely, at this point, a myth that has been debunked. And I think when you look at office, there's going to be and there already is a reimagining of what the office does and what the office provides. And beyond just the hours that people are spending there. But we've seen a great number of people that are returning to the office because they do see value in that, you know, community that you build within an office setting. It's very hard to build culture online.
Correct. And before we get into, you know, online and the internet making brokerage obsolete, just right, because we've been touching on two asset classes that have been proclaimed dead before, let's jump real quickly into another myth, which is basically you always make money in real estate if you hold it long enough, right? And that is definitely not true. We've seen examples of that. If you're in a condo, to your point about the condo warehouses and condo offices, if you're in a condo that isn't well maintained, if you are in an asset class where a tax law changes or a major behavioral shift happens and you have loans coming due, which is what's happening now with the office, you very well may lose money in real estate. If you're in an area that, you know, again, a law changes, a zoning law changes.
I sat with a client one time and he wanted a very high price to sell his property. And I said, that is very doable. It'll take you 10 years to get there, mm-hmm. right? Because it is true that if you hold the land long enough, it will appreciate. However, that's not the approach that you want to take because you don't always have the luxury of time, right? And so when do you make money in commercial real estate? When you buy. When you purchase, that's when you make the money. And what we mean by that is that if you do your research right, and if you bought for the right reasons, meaning that you have an investment philosophy that you want to execute that is based on all the factors that go not only into the location of the asset, but the type of asset that it is, the demographics of the users, the demand that will be maintained, right? And what is the supply surrounding you? You will make money in real estate, but not everybody makes those decisions correctly when they are purchasing commercial real estate. And you are still beholden to the forces of supply and demand. You're still beholden to the forces of you know, to the economic forces. And when you decide to sell, it's also going to affect the money that you're going to make. And listen, there is that management period in between. Some people are very good at managing property, and some people are very inefficient, I will say, at managing property and curating the space. You've heard us speak about that a bunch of times mm-hmm. when we speak about shopping centers, when we speak about offices, even multifamily. You have to have a third sense, you know, a third eye for understanding the dynamics of the personalities that are involved, right? And making sure that they are able to cohabitate and co-live. So, you know, the management part of it is a big part of it.
Well, and holding property for a long time, even though you're waiting to your client's right. point, it'll take 10 years to sell at that price and he might get it in 10 years, is the carrying cost that you have of that asset. It's not like a stock. If you put $100 in the stock, all you pay is that $100 and hopefully that stock goes up. It's not the same with real estate because you have property taxes. You you have to change the roof, you have to fix the AC, right. you have to maintain the plumbing, you know, all the different aspects that come even with the most basic asset class, which is, you know, other than land is a warehouse, right? It's basically right. for most people, it's just a big open rectangular or square box with a roof and some walls and a concrete floor and maybe AC, maybe not, maybe plumbing, maybe not.
Right.
But you still have expenses with that. So if for some reason the value goes down and you're like, oh, well, I'm not going to lose money. I'm going to carry it for 10 years. That's 10 years of you investing and spending money on an asset that your money would be better, you know, kind of cut your losses and invest what you're saving, not maintaining the property.
Yeah, because what you really are describing is opportunity cost.
Correct.
What is the opportunity cost of holding onto the property over that period of time? And you and I have been involved with clients, customers, who are trying to make a bad deal good, right? Right? But they made mistakes when they purchased the property.
Correct.
Right. And then there comes a time where you have to just look at it for what it is and see, is it time to cut our losses? Because we made the wrong assumptions when we made the purchase.
Right.
And we got ahead of ourselves here. Right. And so the market is going to take a long time to catch up, or I might have to do so many different things to the property that I was not counting on doing in order for us to catch up. And that may still take, all of that comes with inherent risk.
Correct.
Right? And risk that you were not anticipating. And so sometimes the best investment is to take a short-term loss for you to take advantage of the opportunity cost that you would lose, right?
Right.
By not taking that short-term loss, invest it in the right vehicle and then see that vehicle grow.
Correct.
Right? And so to me, I think that that is the toughest decision that you make as an investor is when is the time for you to cut your losses. And to your point, not every real estate transaction ends up in a win.
Right. And so let's talk about that, because that's where brokers come in very handy. As you discussed, we were just talking about this with a client that we have who she's going to lose money on her deal. She made huge mistakes when she bought it.
Right.
She's going to lose money, but she's holding on. She's like, no, I'm going to sell it for this. I'm not budging for this. So not only is she going to lose money, the longer she holds it, probably the more she's going to lose. So,
and what happened to her, without getting too much into the weeds, is to say that there was a law that was passed statewide that is also affecting that asset.
Right.
And part of the understanding is that that was not a reality when she
purchased
the property.
Right.
But as much as you want to scream to the heavens,
right,
that is the new reality. And that's not going to change anytime soon.
Right.
So you have to now make adjustments. Just like we've discussed, that there are some statutes that pass that positively affect the value of your asset.
Correct.
Or positively affect the trajectory of your asset. There are equally some statutes that are passed that now are going to make you, if you are a self-reflective practitioner of your craft as an investor, reevaluate whether that's an asset worth keeping.
Correct. And, you know, people, granted, it's an expensive education, but it is an education, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, and I'm thinking of a law that was passed. There was a tax reform law that was passed in the 1980s, and it was way before I got into it, but I remember, before I got into real estate, but I remember it was a huge hit to commercial real estate. I mean, commercial real estate really stagnated for probably the better part of a decade. And I'm sorry, I should have looked up that law beforehand. But again, as we're talking, as we get into this, it triggers other thoughts that I didn't have coming into it. So let's go into how online businesses are going to make brokers obsolete because all the data is online, right? We already covered how that's not true.
Yeah.
And the value of a broker in explaining, like you did to your client, you can try to sell it for this price, but it's going to take you 10 years. Here's why. So
the value is not in the data. The value is in your ability to analyze and synthesize that data and to put it into context so that you can make the best decision for your business, for your investment, you know, for your family, for whatever the ultimate big why is that you are making that investment.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you go online you're going to find a lot of deals. Not every deal is online, as we've already mentioned. So that's one part of it. But another part of it is what you're missing out by not working with an experienced broker, for example, is you're missing out on that personal insight, right? You're missing out on the data analysis, not the data itself, but the data analysis, right? And part of the data analysis is that a big part of our job is risk mitigation, right? And so looking out at what the zoning code is, what is coming down the pipe as far as we can potentially see, right? Changes in the law, changes in consumer behavior, you know, all of those factors that we get so engrossed into it because we do it every day, right? And we do it for multiple people. So when you are working with an experienced broker, you got to almost look at it as every single person that has worked with that broker in the past that has compensated them for their services, right? You get to now take advantage of the experience that they gained through all of those transactions, right? And their understanding of the market. There is also something to be said about the negotiation skills and having someone as a buffer to negotiate. I've worked with people that are better negotiators than me, but they know infinitely in their wisdom, right? That almost like a person should not defend themselves in a court of law, right? That they are better suited to have a buffer in between the seller and the buyer, right? Because it helps in the way that the information is presented to the other side, and it helps in the negotiations, right? And there is also a level of emotional intelligence that is required to navigate all the personalities. You know, one time I remember people telling me, oh, I want to get into commercial real estate because you don't have to deal with people and their craziness. And you don't have to deal with if they don't like the kitchen and they don't like the color and they cannot envision the house looking differently. And I'm like, listen, people are people. We deal with humans.
Right.
Right. We're complex and we're intricate and we're complicated. And the reality is that, you know, we deal with that all the time, regardless. Right. If you're an experienced broker, there is a level of emotional intelligence that you have had to develop in order to have those conversations, because it's not only the customers that you're dealing with. It's the other brokers. It's the people at the city. Right. When you have to go to a municipality and have to deal with a permitting issue, or you have to deal with a zoning issue, or you have to deal with some out of the norm, crazy, you know, left end curve that you were not expecting.
But you've got that down to a science. You just take them empanadas.
I just take them empanadas. I take the approach that, you know, people are usually happier when they are fed. And so, you know, that that tends to work.
But I think your point is valid. And we've talked about this before in terms of knowing your local area politicians and knowing. So because we've been involved in advocacy for so long, as well as real estate, and we know our area officials very well, we also know whisperings that we've been hearing about different things, right? Yeah. So remember when there was the law where they were going to pass a law where every single person had to put lighting on their facility, and it was significantly more lighting than what was already there. There was a whisper about how they were going to tax any vacant, undeveloped land, whether it was maintained or not. There was so you start hearing those whispers, and then you can bring in or you can call, you know, your local official and be like, hey, we heard this. You know, we've been going to the commission meetings. How serious is this? Or is this just being floated to try to get somebody to do something else? Right. Correct. Because if you do. Oh, and the other thing was working with a good attorney. And it's the partnerships that we have. I remember when we had Estrellita Silva, and she worked with me on a deal. And we have a great episode that we did with her. But we were working with her on a deal, and she had heard something that was going to be putting onto another law. They were there, or an ordinance, excuse me. It was a parking ordinance that they were going to, like, tack on that was going to affect a huge huge area, including an area where I was doing a lease. But that wasn't being reported. It wasn't really being spoken about. There were no public hearings. It was just something that they looked at as being like an amendment, right? A little fix it. And then when she was looking for our deal and she went and she heard that, she was like to the commission, do you guys realize what this is going to do? And she showed them in legal terms what they thought was going to be a minor little tweak was going to do to existing restaurant space and outdoor space. So again, if you don't have those connections and you don't have that intel, you could potentially make a huge mistake. And that's where, you know, local area brokers and their relationships with local attorneys and everything come in handy. What was another one? Oh, real estate is a passive investment. I think we've kind of hit on this a couple of times. You know, you just buy a multifamily strip center warehouse and then you just sit back and rake in the money.
Right.
Only if you're a limited partner and even then, or a REIT, you know, if you buy a REIT, but even then you need to read the financials. You need to know what the market's doing to know if your investment is still solid in there. But if you're going to be a hands-on manager, then it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And we know several people, you have several clients also, some who we've interviewed here who own either multifamily or shopping center, and they are the managers and they got into it kind of as a part-time thing. And now it's a full-time job because they're good at it, or they created the platforms that they needed to support their business and their investments. But there's very little passive about real estate investing, but you hear that a lot, you know, like buy real estate, it's a passive investment.
Yeah. No, for sure. There's nothing, there's really no such thing as passive income unless you're getting a stipend or...
Yes.
You know, it's not the same. There's nothing passive about commercial real estate.
Right. Or really about any kind of investing. If you're doing a good job, you really have to do your homework and follow up. So is there anything else? Are there any other major myths that you think we should talk about? We talked about some videos.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll do another episode like this. We've had conversations about this in the past, but when I was looking at thinking about ideas here, one of them was about whether the relationship of the broker and the client after or once they close the deal, is the relationship end right there, right? The deal's closed.
You know, now the client's on the deal.
I think it depends on the deal, but the reality is that, you know, the relationship is, you're always building that relationship and you're always available. And so I remember a quick story that I had a client. He bought this 18 unit apartment building in Miami Beach. And he closed on a Friday, or he closed on a Thursday, and then he was getting on a plane that afternoon for a family trip. And then we get a call the next day that, hey, they're about to cut the water off of everybody because he had forgotten to switch out the account for the water. And so, you know, I called him, he's texting me back and all that stuff. So I had to go to his place. He had a big dog at the time. The dog hadn't met me yet. He says, all right, look, here's where you're going to find the keys. Go into my place. I want you to go into into my office. His dog's name was Samsung. All right. Samsung is a beautiful dog. Right. But a big dog. Right. An intimidating dog. So I walk in and Samsung looked up at me. Went back to sleep. He didn't move at all. I went into his desk. I found the checkbook. I went to the city to make sure that they were able to turn on the account and do all that stuff. So again, that, you know, just deepens the relationship. I just thought of that because it was the idea, you know, the story that came to me when I was like, you know, I had read somebody online saying, well, the myth is that brokers only care about closing the deal and that they don't provide much service afterwards, and I was and that just made me think of that story. And so, you know, we love to continue to be engaged. We want for our clients to be successful. You know, we want them to have success in their endeavor. So you know,
another myth is that it's really hard to get money for a deal.
Yeah.
And We talked a little bit about that, about how much money it takes to get a deal. But the reality is especially in today's market, there's a lot more money out there necessarily than there are deals. Yeah. So there's a lot of money looking for deals. Sure. So thank you for joining us on another episode of Between Two Chairs. If you have any myths you would like us to debunk, please feel free to reach out to either Fernando or myself. We're on LinkedIn. We're
YouTube.
We have everywhere you get your podcasts. And that's podcasts. The end of our announcement.
There you go.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.